The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
I hope you missed us the last few weeks, but we're back and back with a cracker as well. The second player from New Zealand in the series, if you haven't been with us all the way, Michael Campbell was the other man. And if you get the chance, I'd go back and have a listen because that's a fascinating story as well. Now, this podcast takes us somewhere none of the others have been before, namely being the son of a very famous sportsman and what comes with that. I'm sure most of you know, but for those that don't, Ryan Fox's dad is Grant Fox, a World Cup winning rugby legend. And there's some really interesting takes on the positives and negatives of that. Positives like having a dad who knows what it takes to lean on him when he nearly quit Ryan after turning pro. But on the other side, how he had to take special treatment from the rough boys when he was on a rugby pitch because he was the son of Grant. Now, this is the first podcast of this series, I think I'm right in saying this, that where the round is actually from this year. And as you'll hear, it was a whirlwind start to 2019 for Ryan, both on the course, off it as well. And I'm not even sure his European Tour breakthrough win at the World Super Six in Perth takes centre stage. So Ryan, I would take it your round is a little different than it would have been at the end of 2018.
Yeah, pretty happy with the win in Perth in the last.
Because it can't really be a round, can it?
I don't know how to describe it. I don't know how many holes I played that day. I played a lot, but played my best in the four holes of the final, which was nice and felt pretty comfortable in that situation after being in an island last year and playing well down the stretch. And it's also probably quite a nice consolation knowing you're either going to finish first or second in the event and once you're in the final. And yeah, played some nice golf on that Sunday overall and some very good golf in the final.
Can I throw something at you here? Because when you were heading into that third round, I'd noticed that you'd lost a playoff to make the knockout stages in 2017. You failed to qualify by a single shot last year. You lost in a playoff to make the match play for the Belgium knockout finals last year. And the week before, you missed the third round cut at the Vic Open by one shot. So when you're playing the third round, trying to get into that top 24, are those sort of things playing on your mind?
It had definitely crossed my mind on the Friday night, potentially, that I'd not had a whole lot of luck at third round cuts in the last couple of years and sort of wasn't looking that promising either on the Saturday in Perth, where we got out. I was last group and it was seriously windy when we teed off and didn't calm down, and you'd seen guys go out early and shoot lights out. I think there was an 8, a 7, a couple of 6s early, and I was playing with Matt Griffin, who I know well, in the last group, and we're both standing there scratching our heads going, how are these guys this is brutal out here today. And you know, he missed the match play and it certainly wouldn't have taken much from, you know, I'd drop a couple of shots and I missed the match play, but certainly nice coming down the last couple of holes and knowing, you know, I controlled my own destiny. I was probably in the match play unless I did something really silly, and you know, once you're in the match play, anything can happen, and it was nice to get there, and obviously anything did happen at the end of that.
Well, let's go. I mean, because it could have lasted 6 holes. I mean, when Jazz, Jane Wattenanond, in your first round match, the second round, is standing over a 2-footer.
It's a little more than 2. I'd give him 3.5.
Okay, you're there. I'm only watching on TV and it sometimes falls short, is it? So 3.5, when he's standing over that though,
I'm dead.
You're ready to pack your bag.
Hat off, glove back in the bag, I think, at that point. And it was just one of those things, well, you know, you got to make him putt it. You know, it's to win the match. And, you know, he just pulled it. And, you know, you never wish your opponent ill, but it's certainly nice to get a little bit of luck sometimes in a golf tournament. I remember Steve Williams telling me that you need some luck to win a golf tournament. And that certainly felt like a lot of luck there. And I had a great shot the next hole in the playoff. And actually, I probably hold the same putt that Jazz missed to win that match. And it was nice to play some decent golf after that and take advantage of that bit of luck.
You know, we commentators, we can, you know, go into hyperbole and all this kind of stuff, but sometimes does the fact that you think you're going out free you up at all, or are you still tense when you carry on playing?
I think it does free you up a little bit, but I felt I was really tense in the what ended up being the quarterfinal and the semi. Mm. And that was more to do with timing, because obviously a lot of matches went to that playoff, including mine. That second round, or first and second round, everything was quite behind. And I literally went from the 18th tee box straight to the...
Yeah, we should explain. It's a Super 6 Perth, so it's a six-hole knockout match play.
Yep.
And if you don't finish it after six holes, you go to a knockout hole, which
is 100
yards.
Yeah, it was a 100-yard wedge
shot.
So
when Jazz missed, it meant you headed down the extra hole, you knocked it to 3 feet, knocked it in.
Well, that was... He missed on the second playoff hole.
Ah,
so okay. We went through... I think it was three playoff hole. I won on the third playoff hole.
Right, okay.
And then because there'd been a bunch of matches already get to that playoff hole, and we were one of the last, I think we might have even been the last group of the second round matches.
So you had to go straight to the quarterfinal.
We had to go straight to the quarterfinal, and, you know, rushing, doing everything. And I'd never felt kind of settled there. And it was almost the same going into the semi-final. I'd finished and they go, you've got 10 minutes till you tee off again. I've gone, well, I've got to go have some lunch. Ran and scoffed a couple of pieces of beef and some rice for lunch and ran to the tee and teed off again. And it was only when we got to the final that they're like, hey, you've got 40 minutes here, or half an hour or something. So I literally just went and sat in the players' lounge, relaxed, and, you know, had a bit more food and actually had a chance to settle down. And I played my best golf in the final. I think that was just because I had a chance to settle. But, you know, it's nice going into a tournament, as I said, in that final, you know you're finishing first or second. You make the semis, you know you're finishing in the top four.
The semis, because you and Paul Dunn know each other pretty well. So is it strange at all that when you're playing a good friend, and it's obviously, it means so much?
It was a strange match. You know, obviously we both wanted to win, but I mean, it was the comment going down the first or second hole. It's like, you know, whoever wins this, we're going to make sure we win the final. Whoever wins, it's got to win the final. And, you know, it was, Dunners was happy, you know, that I got up over Adrian, and I was certainly happy to see him get up in that third place match as well. And it's a strange dynamic. We don't get to, well, that's the first match play I've played as a professional. And, you know, playing against one of your mates, you know, if I'm playing with him on a Thursday or Friday, I'm not trying to beat him. I want them to play well. You want the guys in your group to play well, because you kind of can feed off that a little bit. Sure. And it's only coming into the back nine on Sunday that you really, you know, it becomes ultra competitive. And it was quite a strange dynamic there. But, you know, I played some pretty decent golf. He let me off a couple of times. He missed a couple of good chances to win holes and a one to halve a hole, which, you know, normally that's his big strength is putting. And again, I probably rode a little bit of luck there. And then, you know, found something that final against Adrian and played absolutely great the last four holes in that final.
Yeah, so you didn't have to go down the last two. I mean, it was a dream final really for you. It seemed like so in control of things.
Yeah, I think, as I said, I had a bit more of a chance to settle for that final. You know, I sat down, I had some food, and then I went out on the putting green. I did, you know, what I'd do in the lead up to a normal round of golf. I didn't hit any balls on the range. I'd obviously played a lot of holes at that point. I wasn't going to cool down that quickly, but I went out and did, you know, five or ten minutes of putting before we teed off, and, you know, got into that a bit more of that normal routine before the start of that match, and, you know, felt pretty calm the whole time. And you know, it would have been nice to have that feeling of holding a putt on the last to win a tournament, but I'm certainly not complaining having to two putt from 15 foot or whatever it was to win. And you know, it was nice to get that, to, I guess, finally get the first win on the board.
Yeah, and coming in Perth, which is where you had your first PGA Tour of Australia win as well.
Yep, yeah, Perth treated me pretty well. I always enjoyed going there. We played some amateur golf there. I played an Aussie amateur at Lake Karrinyup, I think 2008 or 2009. And it's always been one of my favourite golf courses since then. Or I think I played every one bar one of the Super Six or Perth International as it was before that. And then yeah, having a win in WA as well in the WA Open, and I think that was 2015.
If you say so, I haven't checked.
14 or 15.
Around then.
I think it might have been the end of 2014, and you know, played great that week. I think I won by five. So you know, something about WA, it's treated me pretty well, and it was, I guess, the Aussie Tour was the first tour I played on, and you know, nice to have it co-sanctioned between Europe, Asia, and the Aussie Tour, and you know, for it to count on well, three tours, I guess.
So you win, and obviously you're absolutely ecstatic, I take it.
Yep.
But then suddenly, it's like, what am I going to do next? You were now into Mexico.
Well, I didn't know I was in Mexico. So I check with my manager at the end of Sunday night, and he goes, no, yeah. He goes, you're about five or six out on a you know Sunday night or a Monday. So I went back to Auckland, and I
didn't you have a fishing trip arranged?
Yeah, I'd arranged to my now wife had some family over from Holland, and we're taking them up to her parents' beach place, which is in the Bay of Islands, which is a fantastic part of New Zealand. And we had the boat up there, and I was planning on doing a couple tiki touring them around, and when I could go out and do a bit of fishing. And so I'd actually driven up there on Monday night when I landed from Perth. It was a you know three and a half hour drive up there, and spent all day on the boat on Tuesday, ticking touring around, caught a couple of fish, and then I'm sitting at dinner about 9 o'clock on Tuesday night, and Ian Keenan, my manager, rings me and goes, "You're in Mexico." And I think my reaction was, "Oh shit, what do we do?"
And I hope he had the answers. He's your manager.
Yeah, and look, we talked about it a lot. You know, it was
not for too long, I hope, because you had a plane to catch.
Well, I couldn't. I couldn't actually get out that night. Obviously, being okay. In New Zealand, our flights are fairly limited. We you know, there's a flight every night to LA and San Francisco, and that was, you know, that was the obvious way to get to Mexico if I was going to go. But I'd already well missed those. So the next chance I got was actually Wednesday night. So we're talking, well, you're going to get in a Wednesday night to a WGC event at altitude at 8,000 feet. You've played 5 weeks in a row. Is it worth going? And I, you know, talked to Ian, my coach Marcus Wheelhouse, talked to my dad about it, and you know, the decision was, well, you know, it's a WGC, you've got to go. You know, you've got nothing to lose. If you play bad, you know, doesn't matter. You get a chance to tee up against the best in the world. You've got to do it. And so we drove home 3 hours on Wednesday morning, packed my bag, jumped on a plane at 7:30 that night, and landed it in Mexico City at. I got to the hotel at 8:30 p.m. on a Wednesday night, which is, that's the first time I've ever done that for a tournament, let alone something that big.
And about 12 hours later, you're teeing it up alongside the top 60 in the world.
Yeah. And I actually played all right I scored all right the first couple of rounds and played much better on the weekend and scored terrible. It was just one of those golf courses. It was tricky enough to figure out. All the guys I talked to said, you know, we struggled first year here. You know, no one, it took 2 or 3 years for the guys to figure out how far the ball went, how to play the golf course, and I'm trying to do that in 12 hours. So I was on a hiding to nothing, but it was a good experience to go, and hopefully I get a chance to go back and I can at least take some learnings from that.
So you play 5 weeks in a row, you win, then you travel around the world, tee off 12 hours later, come back, and it's time to get married.
Well, New Zealand Open was the following.
Oh my God, yeah.
So I flew into New Zealand Open, landed on a Wednesday morning.
So your national championship.
It was our 100th New Zealand Open. So it was an important one to play. I had Steve Williams caddy for me that week as well. So, you know, he's obviously had a few wins in his career, and the New Zealand Open's one that's missing from his resume as it is from mine. So, you know, we both were very keen on that, and I guess limited preparation didn't help that. And I played all right. I finished tied for 11th in the end. And, got home on Sunday night and then got married the following Saturday. So
with a stag do in between.
I had a stag do on the Wednesday, yep. So luckily that was very tame in terms of punishments and all of that. We did have quite...
They let you off then, did they? Given your punishing schedule before.
Yeah, I mean, we had a fair bit to drink, but that's expected on a stag do. But we had, the worst thing they did was tow me behind the boat we were on a Seabiscuit. I don't know if anyone knows what that is, but it's like a rubber tube that you tow behind a boat. And all the boys stood on the back of the boat and started throwing vegetables and various other things at me. So I kind of got away pretty lightly. That was...
No injuries, no.
I drank a little bit of seawater and didn't feel so good for a little while. But other than that, came away fairly unscathed. And, we had a great day on the Saturday for the wedding. And it was 10 years in the making, so...
She's a patient lady then.
She is a patient lady, and
so you've been together with Annika, isn't it?
Annika, yep.
Annika. Yep. So you've been together 10 years or so?
Yeah, just over 10 years. So been engaged for, I think it was about 15 or 16 months before the wedding, but we always wanted a New Zealand summer wedding, and it was a bit too... We got engaged just before Christmas in 2017. It was a bit too short a timeline to do it early 2018, so I decided, let's do it in 2019 and do it properly. And we had a great venue. The weather looked a bit dicey during the... We had a bit of rain early on, but during the reception, which was in a clear marquee outdoors on an island, it fined up and the wind died down, and we had a great day surrounded by our friends and family, and it was a pretty good party.
Fantastic. But I hear winning the World Super 6 in Perth kind of ruined your wedding speech a little bit.
Yeah, I had a joke planned out, and I've got a great set of mates at home who never let me off anything. And I actually structured my speech as a golf winning speech, and was going to be the only speeches I've actually ever done. So I just run the wedding speech like that, and I was expecting to get heckled by one of them saying, "Oh, you haven't done one in a while." So winning Perth kind of ruined that little joke, but I got to throw it back in their faces a little bit. So the speech went quite well. The joke, the reverse of that joke, got a few laughs. So
yeah, it worked out.
It worked out pretty well, and it was a nice early wedding present for us as well.
Yeah, I mean, what a couple of months, really. I mean, what a fantastic couple of months, but life-changing couple of months.
It was. I guess the goal was to always first to make it onto a major tour and then to win. I've got close a couple of times to winning, and it was nice to, to achieve, I probably wouldn't say a lifelong goal, because I probably only took up tournament golf at sort of 17, 18, but it's been a goal since then. So it's, a long time to be able to tick that one off. And it was pretty special to do it. It was, my wife normally travels with me every week, and it was probably a bit sad for her that she wasn't there to experience it. She was back home tearing her hair out, watching the TV and trying to organise our wedding that I was away for 7 weeks in a row before. So she did a great job of that, but it would have certainly been nice to have her there. But got loads of messages of support. It was great timing for New Zealand. It was sort of late afternoon, early evening, and I know a lot of friends and family back home were watching it, and she certainly was, so it was nice to be able to give them something to cheer for.
If we can go back, obviously, your background is quite well known, but there'll be people listening that might not know. You come from New Zealand, and the number one sport in New Zealand is rugby.
Yep, and comfortably.
One of the number one players of all time when it comes to rugby in New Zealand happens to be your dad.
Yeah.
So what was it like growing up in the house of a sporting superstar as he was?
It's going to sound weird, but it was normal. I don't obviously know. Dad was just dad. He played for the All Blacks, and after he retired, I was six when he retired, so I don't remember a whole lot of him playing. I remember little bits, and I've seen plenty of videos and stuff like that. But him getting stopped in the street and people talking to him, asking for autographs, that was kind of normal when I was 8, 9, 10. It sounds strange, and he was always just dad. I'm obviously very proud of what he achieved and what he, his standing in New Zealand rugby. But for me, he was just dad.
Yeah, I mean, we should point out he was an All Black legend, part of a World Cup winning team.
Yep.
What, 600-odd points he scored, which is up there with the most ever. I don't know if it is.
I think he still might be third, although Beauden Barrett's kind of chasing him down pretty quickly.
And you know, rugby is religion in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So was it just as much as people coming up and asking for autographs? I mean, did it ever interfere in, like, you'd be out having dinner and people were coming up and...
Yeah, you used to get a little bit of that every now and again. And again, it was just kind of normal. You know, Dad was an All Black. Obviously, rugby is like religion in New Zealand. It was, if you make the All Blacks, it's a big deal. And, you know, people want to talk to you and people always have an opinion, whether it's a good opinion or not a good opinion. And, you know, he just used to sit there and listen to it and say thanks and sign an autograph or whatever, and it was just a fairly normal occurrence.
And you said you've watched the old games back with Dad, or
not too much with Dad, but Mum. I think Mum still probably got the tape somewhere at home.
Because that must have been quite surreal watching your dad do those kind of things. I mean, I'm sure you'd love to have seen it live, but
yeah, I remember a little bit. The Lions toured the last year that Dad played in 93, and I remember a little bit of that series. I was six at that point, so I've got some good memories of that. I remember him kicking a goal, I think it might have been for Auckland, to beat the Lions in 93, from 40 odd metres out. Someone's probably going to find it on video and I'll be wrong, but that's the memory that I have as a 6 year old. I've got great memories of going to the changing room after games and used to go out on the field and kick a ball around with some other mates and some other kids of the All Blacks at that time, or the Auckland team. And yeah, that was a whole lot of fun. But again, that was normal, going to the after-match function and getting to run around with all those guys. And even now, Dad's obviously still got some great mates from that era, and hanging around with icons of rugby like John Kirwan and Sean Fitzpatrick and those guys. It's kind of weird, but it's also very, very normal.
But you know, when you're 6, 7, 8, and you know your dad, everyone, you know, you pick you up from school. I mean, what are the other kids like?
Well, he actually coached all our rugby team, all my rugby teams growing up.
What, at school?
Yeah, at school he coached our first 15 when I was.
Wow. When your school must have been pretty good.
Yeah, we were okay. You know, he was my goal kicking coach the whole way through. I played 10 as well.
So no pressure there.
No, yeah, it was. You know, I think he really enjoyed it. He did a fair bit of coaching outside of that. He coached was assistant coach of Auckland and the Blues for a while. I'll get the years wrong, but it would have been the late 90s, early 2000s, that kind of era. And he said that was really hard, and that was much harder and to be involved with from our point of view, because obviously the coaches are the ones that cop the most flack. The players cop a little bit, and I'm sure Dad copped a fair bit in his career, but I don't remember that so much because I was so young. But you remember, you know, the coaching side of things, and when the team didn't do so well, the coaches would get a fair bit of flack there. Thankfully, Auckland and the Blues played pretty decent when Dad was coaching, but he always thought it was a frustrating job. He did a fair bit of commentary as well after he finished playing.
Because so it should be pointed out really as well, because not everyone, this is a golf podcast, rugby back then, it was just turning professional. So, I mean, it's not the financial rewards you might expect for being one of the all-time great legends.
No, it was I think rugby turned professional in 96 was the first year.
So he just finished.
He had finished in 93. So obviously it didn't cost them anything, but a lot of them, they still had full-time jobs. They didn't train full-time like sportsmen do now.
Did your dad have a job?
Yep. He worked in a sports marketing company selling signage and grass painting, which he now still runs, and he owned it for quite a few years as well. So he's literally been in the same job since he was 21 or 22 and playing for the All Blacks and sort of moved up the ranks. And obviously being an All Black helped significantly in that environment, but they still had to hold down a full-time job and take time off to tour and do all of that stuff, which in a major sport now, especially a sport that was so big in New Zealand and still is.
I mean, can you imagine now doing your job and having to do something like that?
Well, I couldn't, literally, the amount of time we have to put in, you can't do it. And it's impressive that the amount of time those guys put in outside of training. They could only train two or three times a week. They'd go into camp to, have intense, 3 or 4 days before they went on tour. But, other than that, they were doing all their fitness stuff outside of work hours. And so the amount of stuff they had to do outside of work hours, work a 9-hour day and then, go to the gym or have to go for a run or go to training after that, a football player or a rugby player doesn't have to worry about that now, and they obviously get paid a lot better. Well, they get paid in general now, but to do that just for it being a passion, and it's impressive the sacrifices they all made. And I know Dad missed the birth of my sister when he was away on tour for the All Blacks, and I'm sure that happens a fair bit in sport nowadays. But it's tough to do it when it's not your job, and it's just a, I wouldn't say it's a hobby, but it's a passion. Obviously, the All Black jersey is rated so highly, seen so highly, but to get nothing else from it but kudos and to see the work they put in, it's certainly shows us up a little bit, I think.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. So you had this with your dad. So I mean, the reason I'm trying to get it, so it's not like you're living in this grandiose environment. It's kind of still very much down to earth. You're not different from your friends in terms of kind of house you're living in.
No.
So there's no kind of jealousy. He's just revered.
Yeah, it is. It is. That's, to be honest, that's what it is in New Zealand now, regardless of what the guys get paid. And to be honest, they don't get paid as much as they do if you're playing for a club in the UK or France. But the All Black jersey has always had that reverence about it, that if you can make the All Blacks, there's only been a very small number of them in our history. It's revered, and especially, guys aren't jealous. And thankfully, I had a lot of friends that probably benefited from it. It's not often as a schoolboy you get to be coached by an All Black, and
sure.
I'm pretty sure most of them got yelled at some point for doing something wrong. But we had a level of expertise that, coaching us as 15-year-olds that not many had, and it was pretty cool. I certainly was on the receiving end of it a fair bit from the opposition. I heard "Let's smash Foxy's kid" a lot, which I did get a fair bit of that. But
did they smash you?
Oh yeah, I copped a fair bit. That's probably why I stopped playing rugby, to be honest. I had a few too many concussions and didn't enjoy it as much as what I had when I was younger. But again, that was sort of all part of it growing up, and if the shoe was on the other foot, I certainly would have tried to do the same thing. So,
can I ask, do you have any brothers or sisters?
I got a younger sister, yeah.
Okay, so younger sister, so she can't really become an All Black. She can in terms of now probably a female rugby unit, but certainly at that time. So in a way, in terms of the mantle of who might follow in his father's footsteps, it was you, and people probably were expecting, given that you did play rugby, that maybe, I mean, if you look at you, you're built like a rugby player.
Yeah, I didn't help myself out, to be honest. I played the same position as Dad. I kicked goals as well. So I kind of opened myself up to a fair bit of criticism in that regard, because it's hard to live up to the level that he played at. And, I was okay at rugby, but I certainly wasn't anywhere near as good as what he is.
What can I just say? There wasn't many other people who were.
No, and yeah. But, I think it might have been easier if I'd have played a slightly different position, and you couldn't parallel it so much. But, the fact that I played the same position, that I kicked goals as well, there was always going to be a comparison there, no matter, the level that, obviously Dad was at the peak of it, but no matter what level I played at, there was always going to be some kind of comparison. And it was just normal growing up. It didn't bother me one way or the other. There just was a comparison. If I missed a kick at goal, I'd get a bit of stick. You're not as good as your old man. I was like, well, I'm not supposed to be as good as my old man.
But it must have bothered you when they're targeting you and hurting you.
Yeah, a little bit, but I guess the great thing about rugby, I'm not a small guy by any means, but playing rugby in New Zealand, I'm not a big guy either. But I could certainly hold my own. I didn't mind. The one thing I had over Dad is I was probably better at tackling than what he was, but he also had Michael Jones on the inside of him for most of his career, so he didn't have to tackle. And for those of you who don't know, Michael Jones was one of the most iconic All Blacks. He's Sir Michael Jones now, just a legend of the game. And you know, that was probably the one thing I had over Dad. I could tackle. I didn't mind getting hit. The only thing that got me was I probably had a few too many concussions.
Okay, because rugby wasn't the only sport that you were playing. Obviously, we're going to come to the golf. But your dad isn't the only famous sportsman in your family either. Is it your grandfather?
Yeah, my mum's father, Merv Wallace, played cricket for New Zealand. Captain New Zealand for a test. He coached New Zealand as well. I think he played from 1936 to 1953.
And was he around when you were growing up?
Yeah, he was. He's passed away now, I think just over 10 years ago now. But he was around when I was a kid, and probably cricket was my number one sport as a kid. Well, actually, all the way through school, cricket was number one, rugby was number two. And you know, he was my batting coach for up till about 12 or 13. And then he became a little bit too frail and sick to be able to help out, but still, you know, I loved going to talk cricket with him. And you know, they were the era that would do 9-month trips to the UK on a boat and you know, play 30 first-class games, or play all the counties, play England a few times. And
so your mum must have been used to what your dad kind of ended up doing as well. So she was used to that in the way that her dad.
Yeah, she was born well after my granddad finished playing cricket, but obviously came from a sporting family, knows the sacrifices it takes to play at the highest level. At that point, my granddad owned a sports shop in New Zealand, so she worked in the sports shop. That's how mum and dad met. Dad worked in the sports shop for a bit as well. You know, that was our whole family has basically been sport since.
And there's you know, rugby playing, cricket playing, and you played.
I played tennis as well.
So what level are we talking here? You were pretty good at.
I played first 11 cricket at school, first 15 rugby at school. I played some representative cricket as a youngster for Auckland.
So this is county level, if you like.
I played my first year out of school. I played senior men's cricket, which is just below county level cricket in the UK. And at that point, golf was probably my third or fourth sport.
So when we say third or fourth sport, how often would you play golf?
I still played golf probably every weekend and a bunch in the school holidays, but in terms of how seriously I took it, I didn't practice. I just played with some mates. I played off two, but it was more to a point. I was, not to sound like a dick, I was just good at sport.
You're one of these people that, you know, make everyone sit you. You pick up a racket, tennis, cricket bat, whatever it is, boom.
I coached tennis some of the way through school, just down at the local tennis club. They had a pro there, but no one to help out. So I'd go and run all the drills and do a little bit for him, just for some pocket money. And you know, golf was probably the sport I enjoyed playing the most because it was the one that was the least serious.
It was just fun,
It was fun. I had a bunch of mates. We all played off single figures. We could all go around our home course and sort of mid to low 70s, take us anywhere else, and we were hopeless. But you know, we had a lot of fun, played a lot on school holidays, you know, spend Sundays at a golf course, go play in the morning, go look for golf balls in the afternoon. And you know, the only practice we did was seeing how much we could spin it out of a bunker on the practice green and that kind of stuff.
Can I ask a question? I'm going to come back to this, obviously, but do you wish it was that fun now? Because now it's obviously more intense and it means so much more because it's your career and future and everything else.
It still is that fun to a point.
Good.
There's a lot more pressure involved, and the bad, when it's bad, it's not fun. I think that's the hard part. You know you've got to keep working through it. Whereas if you have a bad round as a junior, you're like, oh, I don't care, I'm going to play rugby. I got to play rugby tomorrow. I got rugby training and worry about all that stuff. And then you come out next Sunday and it's oh, well, we'll see what happens today. Whereas, you know, now you've got to work your way through it. You know, you do all the other stuff off the golf course, it becomes more serious. But when you're playing well, I still find it as fun as I did when I was 15 and 16.
We'll be back with the interview with Ryan Fox in a minute, but Ryan will be amongst the competitors at the final major of the year, the Open at Royal Portrush, and you've got the chance to add a little bit more excitement to the action in Northern Ireland by playing a superb golf game. It's called the Fitzstairs Fantasy Open. Apologies to those of you listening in various parts of the globe, but you've got to be a UK resident to enter, and you have to be 18 years old and over. It's really simple. All you've got to do is pick a five-man team plus a reserve for the upcoming Open Championship. The winnings of your five players are then added up and they make your final score. There are three different entry fees for this game. You can play for £10, £100 or £1,000. For the Fantasy Masters that was played, the prize pot was a whopping £153,000. Woo! Now, the winner will get to pocket 40% of the prize pot. So it would be a pretty big win, wouldn't it? Now, you've got to be in the top 25 to win. The website will show you the prize breakdown. You can enter more than one team. In fact, enter four, you'll get a fifth free. You can also share the competition with a friend. If they win, you'll win a percentage too. And you'll be in good company as well, as this game is a favourite among Premier League footballers, BBC sports presenters. In the next episode, I'll reveal my lineup of five. Take them or leave them. But to get playing, go to fantasy.fitzdares.com. That's fantasy.fitzdares.com, where you'll also find the terms and conditions. As with all forms of gambling, make sure you play responsibly and be gamble aware. Now, let's get back to that chat with Ryan Fox.
You're listening to the Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Let's go back. So when did it become serious, golf?
Became serious my first year at university. So I actually started a law degree at university.
Why are you laughing?
Well, because I wasn't very good at being a lawyer. But
you know, you were pretty good at sport though.
So. Yeah. So I, if I'm brutally honest, I wanted to be a sportsman growing up regardless. And then sort of after I left school, tried men's cricket and I didn't like it. Rugby. Mum and dad wanted me to go to university. My grades were decent enough to get into first year of a law degree, and I tried that and I hated it. And sort of halfway through that, I played off two. I still played golf every weekend or whenever I could, and probably a bit more during the week because you could get away with it at university. And I thought, oh, stuff it, I'll try tournament golf. I'd played two or three junior tournaments at my home club, maybe one elsewhere, played a little bit of...
How old are we here now?
18.
18.
Or, yeah, 18 and a half. Kind of thing, and I'd played some inter-club stuff for the club, you know, just match play stuff. We called it pennant. I'm not sure what it's called in the UK, but played a little bit of that, but you know, nothing serious. You know, I wouldn't do any practice for it. I'd just rock up on a Sunday and play and see what happened. And yeah, so halfway through my first year of uni, decided I'll play tournament golf, got myself a coach, started doing some practice. And then entered my first couple of tournaments, and it was all on, you know, handicap, what you could get in. They're all stroke play events, but you had to have, you know, sort of be below a two or something to get into these events. And I got myself down to scratch and played really well in my first tournament. Shot a couple of under par rounds, I think, for memory, and thought I really enjoyed that. And that was, I guess, the start of the bug for me, what got me playing tournament golf. And I think it was probably the right decision in the end.
Yeah, well, obviously, it certainly is. But it's what I find interesting is because you were so good at cricket, very capable at tennis, obviously following in the footsteps of your dad at rugby, just how you managed to turn away from all of those, was it just something fated? Because, I mean, you could have carried on playing cricket, couldn't you?
Yeah, I could have. I think in the end, it's going to sound weird because I'm probably quite a patient golfer. Like, I don't get frustrated that easily. I'm not one to throw clubs or get that angry. I used to get really frustrated playing cricket. Maybe I was just really young and I struggled a bit mentally at cricket. I'd get myself to 30 pretty quickly and get out, which we didn't have T20 in those days. I probably would have been a decent T20 cricketer. But
well, the way you hit the golf ball, I wouldn't be surprised.
I played cricket the same way. I liked hitting fours and sixes and hated running between the wickets and, you know, all of that stuff. And I always played golf the same way, just wanted to hit it hard. And I know in the end, after playing a year of men's cricket, I didn't enjoy, well, half a year of men's cricket, I didn't enjoy it. And I'd had too many concussions to really think about continuing playing rugby. I enjoyed playing rugby in the winter. I didn't enjoy, you know, getting up on a Sunday morning after playing on a Saturday and not being able to move, or having a headache for a week after playing. So, you know, in that regard, it was an easy decision to give up rugby. And tennis was always just a bit of fun, but not too serious. And as I said right at the start, golf was probably the game I enjoyed the most. The social side of it, the fact that it was on you. You know, if you played well, you felt good. If you played bad, you felt bad. It wasn't like a rugby game where you could play great individually and the team would still lose. That, I always found that a little bit hard. Same cricket-wise, the team could win, but you could go out and make a duck and drop a catch in the field and you'd feel pretty terrible about yourself. But the team would win, so that all feel great. I think, you know, golf was a bit easier to reconcile the feelings a little bit, and I enjoyed the challenge of that a little bit more than rugby and cricket in the end.
Fair enough. So 18, 18 and a half, you start taking it a bit more seriously. When did it become the job for life?
I guess I made my first New Zealand squad. I think I was 21, and the tournament I had was the best tournament I had to that point was the week my grandfather died, actually. It was one of our big amateur tournaments in New Zealand, and I finished second behind Danny Lee. And my grandfather had died on the Wednesday. I'd gone back, it was a 4-hour drive from Auckland. I'd gone down to the tournament. He was been sick for years, but not that sick, and got called back, went back. He passed away on the Wednesday night, and Mum said, look, you just go and play. You can't do anything here. Just go and play. And I sort of went down and played like I literally didn't care. And I finished second that week behind Danny Lee, who at that point won everything in New Zealand. He won by 5 or 6 shots. But that was sort of the week that I thought, well, you know, I might be able to, I might be all right at this. And then probably because of that result, I made the New Zealand Academy, made a New Zealand team later on that year. And that's when it became a bit more serious. And when I finished university, ended up with a Bachelor of Arts majoring in psychology, did a little bit of sports psychology as well. And
were you a better sports psychologist than lawyer?
Much better. To be fair, I was a hopeless uni student. I was all right at getting grades, but I was really bad at going. So I ended up...
Well, I can imagine you just wanted to be out playing something.
Yeah, and actually... to be honest, the first couple of years outside of uni playing full-time golf were probably harder than being at university, because you have to go to a few classes here and there, and when I was in class, all I wanted to do was practice, so it was easy to go and practice when I had nothing else to do but go and practice. And often, you know, there were some days where you needed a break, but you felt like you had to go and practice, and it took a little bit to figure out what worked in that regard. And maybe the first 6-8 months I was out of university, I didn't have the balance right and got a bit frustrated with golf and all of that stuff. But, you know, at uni it was pretty easy to just go. I wanted to play golf, that's all I was worried about. And it was, I really enjoyed my golf through there, and getting to play for New Zealand, played in Eisenhower, played a couple other events. I think we finished fourth in the Eisenhower the year I played. And yeah, it was a lot of fun, and thankfully been able to carry that on into professional golf as well.
So mid-20s, you decide to turn pro. The Australian Tour was the natural first stop. It wasn't easy, was it?
No, I think the transition in golf from amateur to professional golf is the hardest. You know, probably the hardest part of the whole journey.
Because people probably wouldn't understand why that would be.
It's just, say, going to Q school for the first time. Obviously, there's a few guys a year that play well enough to get invites. And, you know, someone like John Rahm springs to mind, who's probably the last guy that did it. Came straight out of college and got some PGA Tour starts, played great. He never had to go to Q school. But for the thousands of other golfers every year that want to turn pro, you have to go to Q school. And it's a week... You know, it's in the end, it's another tournament, but it's a tournament you feel like you are literally playing for your livelihood. And it took, that was probably the most pressure-filled week of my life, the first Q school I went to. Thankfully, I played well. I think you had to finish top 10 to get a full card in Aussie, and I finished 7th in the end. And played all right my first year on tour, had some decent tour events, played well in the pro-ams to sort of help out money-wise. And it was probably the second year on the Aussie tour that was the tough year. That was the year I was probably very, very close to giving up the game. And
I hear you said, I'm done.
Yep, I said it to Dad.
Because Dad's caddying for you, isn't it?
Yeah. So Dad literally caddied the majority of my amateur career. Even did a few trips to the States long term, you know, for 2 or 3 months to caddy for me. And it was always fun having him around. We may have had a few disagreements, as most fathers and sons do, but you know, it was great to have him out on tour, and I probably learnt a lot from him in that. Obviously, top level sports, very, very similar mentally, no matter what the sport is.
And there's a bit of technique involved with kicking that you could probably relate to golf as well.
Yeah. And he was, you know, it was like having a full-time psychologist without actually having, you know, being termed a psychologist. You know, there was...
Caddies are that sometimes,
aren't
they?
Caddies are that, and obviously Dad had more experience than, you know, anyone I knew at under pressure, and you know, he was always renowned as being very mentally strong.
So you say to this all-time rugby legend who must have had so many mental struggles to overcome in his journey to hit the peak of his sport, and you say to him, "I'm done."
Yep.
What's his reaction to that?
Well, I guess the context of that happening was I had 2000 and. I'm going to get the year wrong, but my second year as a pro on the Aussie Tour.
2013.
I'd changed coach, I'd played terrible in tour events. I'd played okay in some pro, I'd won a couple of times in four round events outside of the tour events, but I'd, under the pressure of playing tour events, I'd really struggled. And I didn't have enough money up to keep a card. We had three events left on the tour, and they were the three biggest events, the Aussie PGA, the Aussie Masters, and the Aussie Open. And I had Dad couldn't caddy for me at the Aussie PGA. I missed the cut there and played absolutely terrible. And I remember talking to him basically in tears after that finish, saying, "I'm done." And he said, "Look, I'll come over and caddy for you at the Aussie Masters. And we sort of sat down at the start of that week, and it was like, "Why do you play golf?" I was like, "Well, it's supposed to be fun." It really wasn't very fun at that point. He said, and he understood that. He obviously went through some of that in his rugby career. And he said, "Let's just go out there and just try to have fun. Not worry about what's going to happen." You know, at that point, I was going back to Q school in Aussie or not. In hindsight, I probably would have gone back because I had a month or so after the Aussie Open to probably think about it, and you know, I probably would have gone back, but the week after that Aussie PGA, I didn't want to play. If I didn't keep my card, I was, you know, in my head, I was done. We just went out and we played Royal Melbourne that week, which is one of the best golf courses in the world, one of the toughest golf courses in the world as well. And I just went out and tried to have fun. I had no expectations and actually finished 5th that week. It was.
So from I'm done to a big event and finishing.
Yeah.
I mean, all the big names are there.
Yeah. And our Adam Scott won it. Matt Kuchar finished 2nd. Vijay Singh finished 3rd.
You can't remember who finished 4th?
I think it was Matt Griffin, actually.
Okay. And then you.
And then I finished. It was 5th or tied 5th. I can't remember that point. But and, you know,
I'm back.
Yeah. At that point, it was I've at least got a car. I've got a job for next year. I went out and I played crap the Aussie Open the next week and missed the cut. But at that point, I was done mentally for the year, but at least I'd taken all the pressure off. Thankfully, at that point, the Aussie Tour didn't pick up until late January, and this was late November. So I had a couple of months to just relax and get my head in a better space and do a little bit of work on my golf game. And that was all... it needed. And to be honest, I don't know where I would be if I hadn't have finished as high, well, in the top 10 that week. Yeah, I went.
And it's interesting because your dad, you know, he could have given you a kick up the backside. You don't know you've been born. Look at you. You don't know what you've got. And
yeah,
but he didn't. He just went, let's have some fun.
Yeah, and I think it was just what I needed to hear. A couple of other things had worked that week. I'd been talking to my coach and kind of found a little bit of something that worked, that I could, something easy setup wise that I could just try to do every shot, and I was hitting it okay. So in that regard, it was, I felt a bit more comfortable with my golf game than I felt the previous week, and mentally dad had taken all the pressure off. It was just go out, don't worry about what happens, just go and have some fun, try to hit some golf shots. You know, don't worry about anything else. What will be. And, you know, he'd had some situations like that in rugby and might have done the wrong thing and the first time he did it, and then done the right thing the second time it happened. And, you know, thankfully he was there to help out, because I don't think without, you know, those words of advice and his help that week, it would have...
We'd be sitting here chatting.
Yeah, probably not.
You don't know
what would have happened. As I said, looking back on it, I probably would have gone back to Q School if I hadn't have kept my card. But on that day, or on that couple of weeks, you know, I was this close to not wanting to ever play golf again.
And I don't want to go too fast, but you know, I've taken up a lot of your time. So I mean, You then win. When we mentioned the 62 that you won in Australia, your second win. Then you go to Europe. We've talked about the win that's the one that gets you European Tour car, pretty much. You finish fourth on the Challenge Tour rankings. And now you're a European Tour player. I mean, coming from New Zealand, first of all, it's still not easy, is it? Because, you know, home still is pretty much on the other side of the world.
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, I think... You know, I learnt a lot that first year I played Challenge Tour in 15 from, you know, knowing the travel's just too hard. You know, in 2016 we rented a place in the UK. We're never there very long, but just something about, you know, being able to go home if you miss a cut or if you've got a week off, you can just go, you know, go
rather than a hotel.
And you know, there's something about living out of a suitcase that's tough, and just having your own things around is nice. I think deep down too, you know, even though if you're renting a place, you're still paying for it for a week, but, you know, having to fork out for a hotel for a week in between events or an Airbnb or, you know, whatever, that it still feels like a week on tour when you can go back and, you know, go to your place and just
your sit on in the cupboard or whatever, yeah, you know.
Sit on the couch, watch TV, just zone out, you know, that somehow makes a difference. And we learnt a lot from that year. So we bought a place in the UK now and have it, you know, again, we're only here 6 weeks a year, but just having that base, we've got some stuff we can go back, repack. It's nice to be able to play a couple of events in Wentworth and Walton Heath this year that I can stay at home. That's made it a lot easier. We still go back to New Zealand over the European winter, and that's nice because, from what I've heard, the European winter's not overly pleasant. And you, at least at that point, all the events are either the Middle East or Asia or Australia, South Africa, and
they're easy commute.
yeah. Dubai is still a 17-hour flight, but it's one flight. You know, you can kind of get away with it.
So your time on the European Tour is very much focused on the Rolex series. But if only every week was a Rolex series event for $7-8 million, eh?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you why I've played well in those events. Just I've picked good weeks to play well, really. I mean, that's, you know, you can't, you know, as a sportsman, you can't play well every week. I think, you know, talking to Dad about it and talking to any sports psychologist, you know, you play great 20% of the time, you might play average 70% of the time, and you might play badly 10% of the time. And thankfully, the 20% of the time that I've played well the last couple of years have been in the Rolex series events, and generally in Ireland and Scotland, and added a couple more in Italy, and a couple of majors as well, which I've played okay in. So Can't tell you why. I do love links golf, so that maybe makes sense for Ireland and Scotland. But I played great at French Open last year as well in a Rolex Series event. Yeah, it's just picked a good time of year to play well.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, I was watching, I wasn't commentating, but I was watching the Irish Open. It looked like it was yours. I mean, did you feel like that? I mean, could you get that far ahead of yourself?
The only time I thought I probably had it is 18's a tough enough hole as it is. And I got the tee shot away on 18 in regulation and thought, I'm okay here. It's going to be pretty hard to mess 18 up from where I am.
Yeah, booming drive.
Yeah. Yeah. And we hear, I was playing with Danny Willett and we're walking down the fairway and hear a big cheer on 18. And Danny looks at me and goes, "Don't worry, it'll be Jacqueline. It'll be Raphael Jacqueline. It's all right." And we sort of get around the corner and see Raphael putting. So when at that point, I know that Russell's done something. I don't know what he's done. And then sort of see the scores change and know I have to make birdie to win the tournament. And to be honest, and I had a great second shot in there, and I had a putt exactly where I wanted to hit. I just misread it slightly, and that's golf sometimes. You know, you can hit a great shot and get a bad bounce or misread it slightly, and it doesn't go where you want it to go. And in my head, especially looking back on it now, I felt like I won that tournament. Russell just did something incredible, and I didn't see the putt in regulation he held on 18 till after the playoff had finished, and to hold two putts.
Well, you saw the one in the playoff.
I saw the one in the playoff firsthand.
And that was almost an action replay.
Yeah. And to see, you know, where both those putts hold from, and the putt in the playoff, you know, I was fairly close to the hole when it went in, reading my putt, and it was perfect. You know, it went in perfect speed, dead in the middle, and it looked like his one in regulation when I saw on replay, it went in the same. I mean, you can't do anything about that. Unfortunately, I was the one on the receiving end of it. But, looking back on it, there's nothing more I felt like I could have done.
So just to finish off here, Ryan, you mentioned earlier about how your wife wasn't present for the win. I suppose, in a way, there's an added incentive for this to be the first of many and for her to be present in the next one.
Yeah, that would certainly be nice. She travels pretty much every week and has done for the last couple of years, obviously, being from New Zealand, it's a long way away, and we've got a base in the UK, but she's not able to work in the UK, so it's either she'd spend all the time in New Zealand and we wouldn't see each other, or she'd travel. So it's been good having her on the road, and I certainly hope I can get a win on tour with her there. She's had a win in a small event in Tahiti on the bag, which
so she's seen a win.
She's seen a win firsthand, and I think she was there my second challenge to a win in Northern Ireland as well. She was there the whole week, which was nice, but it would certainly be nice to get her a win in Europe as well while she's there.
Or why, she hasn't been to one and she's been to one. How about a major?
That'd be nice.
You wouldn't say no.
Oh, I'm pretty sure everyone would say no to that. Well, every golfer wouldn't say no to that.
But you must now be thinking there is another level here.
Yeah, I guess I felt comfortable for a little while out on tour now and feel like my best golf can compete with, the best golfers in the world. And, it was nice to get over the line. I think a lot of people say the first win's the hardest. I certainly hope that's the case for me. I'm not sure opening the floodgates is the right term, but at least, when I put myself in that position again, there's no pressure, no extra pressure there to win. You've done it. I kind of had the feeling after Ireland that I'd almost done it. Obviously Russell holding 2 40-footers on the last. I got no control over that, and I did everything I could control well. So at least I felt, I could compete, and hopefully, I played a few majors now. It certainly would be, goal's not the right word, dream to win one. I think every professional golfer wants to win one, and I've got a fair bit of work to do to get to that point, but it's, you know, nice to know that my good golf can compete with those guys, and I'd love to have a have one of my good weeks in you know, in a big event like, you know, one of the majors, and you never know what can happen.
You never know. Fantastic. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, what an insight that was, wasn't it, into being the son of a famous legend, the number of sports that Ryan could have been proficient in. I have a feeling if he'd have been born maybe 5 years later or so, he could have been a T20 cricketer. But what a gentleman as well. That's how I would describe Ryan Fox first. We had to record that interview in two parts, and he was so giving of his time. There was no hint at all whenever I spoke to him he was doing me a favour, which ultimately these players are due by sitting downs. But I think he's got all the attributes to be a top-level golfer. And while I don't want to do what everyone else does, which is make the comparisons to his dad, he does have all the attributes to make it like his dad to the top of his sport. Thanks to our sponsors, as always, Navigate Contracting and Red Ray. Thanks to you for listening as well. And I'm really excited about the next guests that are coming your way over the coming weeks. But for now, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games, and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.